the doctor's adopted son, Neil, lived in the barn behind the house, and we became lovers. And he was tortured by the fact that he was obsessed with a 13-year-old. The power dynamic shifted in the relationship, and he became sort of like this dog that I could tell him to do anything, and he would do it. I became one of these people who used to reek of alcohol in the morning. So, you know, it came to a point where I had to be fired or go to rehab. When things are that catastrophically terrible in your life, there's a certain point where, you know what, it's just funny.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The United Methodist Church ends its queer prohibitions. Queensland protects gender diversity and legalizes sex work. And Augustine Burroughs runs with scissors to dry. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 4th, 2024. The United Methodist Church's 40-year ban on queer clergy is over. There was no debate at the General Conference meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the vote was overwhelming. 692 delegates voted in favor and only 51 opposed. The prohibition against what it called self-avowed practicing homosexual clergy that began in 1984 ended on May 1st. The General Conference's LGBTQ positive resolutions continued. United Methodist clergy will now be allowed to officiate church weddings for gay and lesbian couples, with no sanctions against those who refuse to do so. It will now be permissible to use church funds to do what the old rule blocked, promote acceptance of homosexuality, as it said. The United Methodists have been battling their way towards becoming a more queer, welcoming church. At the 2019 General Conference, it was agreed that churches would be allowed to leave the denomination if they were uncomfortable with full LGBTQ inclusion in the church. More than one in five congregations has since been approved to disaffiliate, according to the United Methodist News Service. Most have joined the Global Methodist Church. The newly established denomination's creed states, "Human sexuality is a gift of God that is to be affirmed as it is exercised within the legal and spiritual covenant of a loving and monogamous marriage between one man and one woman."
Anti-queer protests and incitement to violence by groups opposed to LGBTQ equality in Kenya must stop. A court in Mombasa ruled this week in a case naming certain faith leaders and politicians. The plaintiff individuals and the Center for Minority Rights and Strategic Litigation filed suit after members of a national lobby group called the Anti-LGBTQ Movement invaded a health clinic that welcomes queer people. They charged that the assailants spread hateful misinformation. The attack was in response to the Supreme Court's order that the National Gay and Lesbian Rights Commission must be registered as a non-governmental organization. Individual activists and the queer advocacy group sued Police Inspector General Hafet Kome last October for not intervening in the rapidly anti-queer street demonstrations. Mombasa High Court Judge Olga Sewe's April 29th ruling was only temporary. She set another hearing for July 24th. The petitioners, Respondent Kome, and the anti-LGBTQ movement must file their witness lists and counter-arguments within 14 days thereafter. Sewe's order states, "Pending the July 24th hearing and determination of this petition, this honorable court does hereby issue a conservatory order restraining the respondents from calling on or inciting members of the public to carry out extrajudicial killing, lynching, punishing, stoning, forcible conversion, or any other means of harming LGBTQ plus identifying persons and their homes." Sewe also forbade them from attempting any expulsion from Kenya or any party of Kenya of LGBTQ plus identifying persons or closure of organizations serving LGBTQ plus identifying persons.
The Australian State of Queensland's Anti-Discrimination Act will now include gender-diverse, non-binary, and intersex people. New laws will also decriminalize sex work. The anti-discrimination additions came into effect on April 29th. There are now enhanced penalties for crimes motivated by hatred or serious contempt and beefed-up vilification protections. The legislation is long overdue to Queensland Human Rights Commissioner Scott McDougall. He pointed out that it also criminalizes the display of certain hate symbols. Queensland's Parliament approved a bill to decriminalize consensual adult sex work on May 2nd. It had been legal under certain circumstances. The new measure protects all sex workers with specific health and safety rules and regulates their industry like any other business. It also outlaws discrimination against sex workers and protects anyone from being coerced into sex work, including children. Queensland Attorney General Yvette Doth said that the new laws ensure workers have access to the same human rights and workplace health and safety protections as other Queensland workers. These reforms will make the sex work industry safer, fairer, and reduce stigma and discrimination. Activist groups like Respect Inc., Decrim QLD, and the Scarlet Alliance have been lobbying for full decriminalization for many years. Respect Inc. State Coordinator Lulu Holliday said, "Under current laws, sex workers are reluctant to report crime. Barriers to accessing justice are reduced when sex work is no longer criminalized." Queensland joins the states of Victoria, New South Wales, and the Northern Territory to fully legalize adult sex work.
U.S. state-funded healthcare plans must include coverage for gender-affirming treatments, including surgeries. This according to a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on April 29th. The Richmond, Virginia-based bench became the first federal appeals court to come to that conclusion. It had combined similar cases under its jurisdiction filed in North Carolina and West Virginia. Both state attorneys argued that their denial of coverage was not discriminatory because it was based strictly on cost concerns. Lower courts in both cases had declared the denials unconstitutional. The appeals court upheld those conclusions. Fourth Circuit Judge Roger L. Gregory wrote for the majority that denying coverage was obviously discriminatory on the basis of both gender and sex. North Carolina and West Virginia officials are promising appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration was busy reinstating protections from the denial of care based on sexual orientation or gender identity under the Affordable Care Act. Donald Trump's administration rescinded those Obama-era provisions. The Department of Health and Human Services issued the decision this week, reaffirming that Section 1557 protects LGBTQ people because it outlaws sex-based discrimination. Secretary Javier Becerra declared, "I am very proud that our Office for Civil Rights is standing up against discrimination, no matter who you are, who you love, your faith, or where you live. Once again, we are reminding Americans we have your back."
The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is updating its regulations involving transgender workers for the first time in more than two decades. These revised federal guidelines will better protect them from harassment and discrimination. The EEOC defines such offenses as misgendering, deadnaming, or denying access to the appropriate bathroom as violations of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It bans workplace bias based on sex. The new guidelines take effect immediately. They also specifically prohibit harassment of workers who are pregnant, have just had a child, are breastfeeding, or have had an abortion. EEOC's announcement referenced the U.S. Supreme Court's 2020 Bostock decision. It defined anti-queer employment bias as a form of sex-based discrimination. EEOC guidelines are not considered to be federal law, but they're frequently cited in workplace discrimination lawsuits.
Finally, two bills intended to further restrict the rights of transgender people in Mississippi died of Republican infighting in the state legislature this week. One proposal declared, "There are only two sexes, and every individual is either male or female." The other was to deny trans people access to bathrooms, changing rooms, and other sex-segregated facilities that matched their gender identity. The State House of Representatives and Senate had approved different versions of the bills. Members from each chamber could not reconcile them before the legislative session ended this week. Republican Governor Tate Reeves was likely eager to sign them. He enthusiastically signed a ban on trans female athletes competing in women's sports. Most recently, he approved outlawing pediatric gender-affirming health care. Black Democratic Mississippi State Representative Zakiya Summers condemned the bathroom bill during debate, saying, "It reminded me of what my ancestors had to deal with at a time when they couldn't go in the bathroom either."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending May 4th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of the newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
I heard what you said. I'm not stupid, you know. What do you take me for, hetero? The next time you say it, make sure I can't hear, 'cause you're pissing me off. Is that clear?
What did he say?
He said that's okay.
Hi, this is Chris Freeman from Pansy Division. You've been listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Augustine Burroughs is one of the world's leading memoirists. His first book about his life was Running with Scissors, a 70-week New York Times bestseller published in 2002.
The orange light from the dehumidifier that sits next to the wicker laundry hamper is looking at me, and I look back at it. Normally, it would terrify me, but because my mother is here, it's okay. Except she is walking fast, has already walked halfway across the family room floor, is almost at the fireplace, will be turning around the corner and heading up the stairs, and then I will be alone in the dark bathroom with the dehumidifier eye. So I run. I run after her, certain that something is following me, chasing me, just about to catch me.
Before he wrote Running with Scissors, Burroughs wrote Dry, but it came out second in 2003.
Like once, I had to do an ad for hair conditioner. The strategy was, add softness you can feel, body you can see. But the thing is, this was a lousy product. It made your hair sticky, and in focus groups, women hated it. Also, it reeked. It made your hair smell like a combination of bubblegum and Lysol.
His truth is stranger than fiction, but Burroughs makes surviving his horrific childhood and addicted young adulthood at times hilariously funny. Running with Scissors and Dry were still changing the memoir genre, and his 2004 book, Magical Thinking, was just about to debut when he met correspondent Steve Pride.
There are very few originals in the world. Augustine Burroughs is one. His memoir, Running with Scissors, and its sequel, Dry, are horrific and yet screamingly funny. That's a pretty neat trick.
I'm Augustine Burroughs.
For people that haven't yet read Running with Scissors, tell us about your very unique childhood.
it started off normal enough. You know, I had two academic parents. My father was the head of the mathematics department at the University of Massachusetts, and my mother was working on her graduate studies in creative writing. Things started to go wrong when I was about 8. My parents had a really unhappy marriage, and that's not so uncommon. You know, that's not memoir material. You know, they fought a lot. What began to happen was that my mother's brain sort of rewired itself, and she began to go crazy. She was a poet, and I think she began to identify a little too strongly with Anne Sexton. And in order to save their marriage, my mother and father began to see this psychiatrist named Dr. Finch. They went for weekly therapy sessions, and, you know, it didn't work, as it doesn't work a lot of the time. So my parents divorced. My mother began to see Dr. Finch every week and then, you know, a few times a week. And then I began to see Dr. Finch. And he looked like Santa Claus. That was my first impression of him. He was a short, big guy with white hair and a white beard and big, white, bristly eyebrows. And he was very charismatic, and he sort of talked like this. And he was very sort of captivating guy, a lot of charisma. He was also insane, sort of Charles Manson, I guess, without the machete. And my mother became just in this odd sort of symbiotic relationship with him, and gave him all sort of control of her mind. So she went completely crazy, could not take care of me anymore. And when I say crazy, I mean she was, you know, having to be hospitalized in mental hospital. She would have psychotic episodes. You know, she was hallucinating, and she was hearing voices, and she was seeing things, and she was smoking cigarettes in the bathroom with her dead grandfather. She was literally crazy. And I started spending more and more time with the doctor. And over time, I began to spend some time at the doctor's house. And the doctor's house was this dilapidated pink, peeling, falling apart Victorian in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is a very pristine, well-heeled college town, Smith College. And the street was beautiful, you know, with one beautiful house after another, and then this eyesore of a house with a dirt lawn and a falling down barn in the back. And the doctor's family lived there. He had like 6 kids and patients and adopted children, you know. And it was a large, large, busy house. And he had this beaten down sort of martyr of a wife. And the doctor had a daughter, Natalie, who was around my age, and she was this very precocious, kind of ratty, greasy, funny girl, and her slightly older sister. And we would play. And basically what happened was one day my mother said, "You're going to live here from now on." And so when I was 13, she signed me over, legal guardianship, to this doctor. This was a place where there was no school. That was it for school. There were no rules. There was no structure. I mean, you know, there was no bedtime. There was nothing that you think of as normal, you know, nothing that you think of as the way things are supposed to be. I mean, we were really wild, sort of loose kids left to our own devices, sort of Pippi Longstocking, but darker in a way. The doctor's kids were all very eccentric. I mean, they were very, very, very highly energized and sexualized. And I felt like a little nerd because I was this little prissy thing, you know, in my polyester slacks. And here I was suddenly in this house with just dog hair everywhere and squalor and just kind of filth and loud shouting. They were very confrontational, you know. So I had to sort of shapeshift to become one of these people suddenly. And there was a guy, the doctor's adopted son, Neil, lived in the barn behind the house. And he was 33. And we became lovers, if you can call it that.
How old were you at that time?
I was 13. Basically what happened was that I had confided to the doctor's secretary and second oldest daughter, Hope. You know, I told her I was gay. And she basically felt, you know, you should talk to my brother, Neil, because so is he. So Neil and I developed this friendship based on me sort of coming out to him and telling him about what was going on with me and how I felt abandoned and I was gay and all these sort of problems that I was feeling at the time. And it took me a long time to realize actually what happened. I say that we developed this sexual relationship, but it wasn't actually quite that simple. As I talk about in the book, there was a pretty violent sort of rape scene. He lived in the barn, then he moved out to his own apartment in a town nearby, East Hampton. And I went up to look at some photographs that he had, and he just raped me, you know. And then he said, "There, you still think you're gay?" And I just remember feeling just pure hatred toward this guy. I hated him, and I just wanted to kill him. But that's not what happened. What happened is that he became obsessed with me, and he was tortured by the fact that he was obsessed with a 13-year-old. The power dynamic shifted in the relationship, and he became sort of like this dog that I had, that I could tell him to do anything and he would do it. It's a happy story in the sense that, I mean, I survived it. And the way I survived it was I retreated into my own internal world. I wrote in journals all the time. I carried these spiral 5-subject notebooks, and I would just focus on the page and write what was happening to me. And that was how I got through it. And there was a lot of also fun. There was always something happening. The doctor was fond of having parades. So he would, you know, tie us up in balloons and, you know, go celebrate World Father's Day. One thing the doctor also did is he felt that God spoke to him through the toilet. The shape of people's bowels in the toilet would indicate our future. So he was going through this phase where he would do toilet bowl readings of his daughters. And I mean, there's just this stuff that's just so gross and vile and ridiculous that, I mean, you had to laugh at it. When things are that catastrophically terrible in your life, there's a certain point where, you know what, it's just funny.
This is Augustine Burroughs, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian news magazine.
I am Steve Pride, and we are speaking with Augustine Burroughs, author of Dry and Running with Scissors. Augustine, when I finished reading Running with Scissors, I was so hopeful that the next chapter of your life, which you chronicle in the book Dry, would document a happier time for you.
Dry picks up more or less where Running with Scissors left off. And what actually happened to me is that I got into advertising as a copywriter, and I got it. I understood it because, you know, you'd have someone come along, some company, some manufacturer, and they, you know, theoretically they say to you, you know, we've got this toothpaste that we think is pretty great, but here's the problem. If you brush your teeth with it 4 times a day, it's going to cause mouth cancer and you're going to lose your jaw. And I look at that and I think, okay, great. Hey, now there's a toothpaste, and just brush your teeth once a day. I always see the positive side, and that's why I was so good at advertising, and I was really successful, and I loved it, you know? And it was like, yeah, give me your exploding car, you know? Give me your Band-Aid that causes a rash. I could find the plus side, the positive spin. So now I was living in New York, and I was making money, and I mean, I was just like, you know, bring on the martinis. And that's basically what it was like for me. I mean, I was working in advertising, having a great time, and drinking hard all the time. Yeah, to have fun and go out, definitely, and go to bars, because I was really shy. I could never meet guys unless I was drunk, and I could never go to a gay bar unless I was drunk, and I could never talk to anybody unless I was drunk. But also because if I let myself just sit for 5 minutes without having to write an ad and without having a drink in my hand, I got sad and I got worried and I got scared because I felt so damaged. I felt so flawed that if I looked at it for more than 5 seconds, it was going to crush me. Now, the thing about alcohol that I discovered is that it's really great in a lot of ways. You know, it's definitely a social lubricant and it makes you less inhibited and it really is a lot of fun. I don't regret drinking. I had a great time. I loved it. It made me so uninhibited that I had experiences I never would have had, but I'm kind of glad I had them. But eventually, the physiology took over, and I became one of these people who used to reek of alcohol in the morning. So, you know, it came to a point where I had to be fired or go to rehab. So I was confronted, you know, at a job, and, you know, so I went out. I shipped myself off to a gay rehab center in Minneapolis thinking, oh, this is going to be like a spa, you know, Ian Schrager. It's going to be really swanky. I'm going to have 400 cotton Egyptian sheets on the bed, you know, and large glass pictures of ice water with lemon, and it's going to be just terrific. And, you know, it was horrible. It was just horrible. It was hospital with fluorescent lights and magic markers with boards. And it was like medical school for alcoholics with a bunch of gay guys who all had, like, let their hair go and were, like, looking just like crap. Sorriest group of fags you ever saw collected in a room. And surly dykes just sitting there. Happy hour was so over. And so I'm in rehab, and now all this stuff I didn't want to think about, I got to think about. I mean, I want to check out immediately. And for the first 3 days, every day, I was there hour by hour. Eventually, you know, some of it started to make sense. I started to realize, yeah, okay, all these people around me that are all freaks and serious rock-bottom alcoholics, of which I, by the way, am not, all of a sudden I realized I have kind of everything in common with them. I mean, I have my apartment back home in New York filled with 1,300 empty bottles of Dewars, which when I was living with it seemed fine. The apartment was complete squalor, and I'm making six figures, and I'm in advertising, and I'm wearing an Armani suit, and I'm coming home, and I'm sleeping in sheets that I had peed in the night before, and there are fruit flies rotting all over the apartment, and I have this collection of bottles. And when you live like that, when you're in the middle of it, as anyone out there listening who does live like that can tell you, it doesn't matter because you don't see it. You know, I was focused on the computer, so I didn't see it. And it kind of becomes like a comfortable bird's nest. You know, you pad the filth and squalor down. You make a path from the bed to the refrigerator, to the bathroom, to your desk, and, you know, you don't see it. But if I heard anybody in the hall, I remember I would freeze and be perfectly quiet because I didn't want them to knock on the door because I could not open the door. I could not open the door. I was not a writer with a capital W when I wrote Dry. I was just a guy who was a mess, who got out of rehab and all of a sudden realized there are a lot more hours in the day than there used to be. Now I'm feeling the minutes, you know? It's like, okay, I'm sober. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm sober. This is terrific. Time passes. It's 4:37. I'm sober. And this goes on one day, day by day, for the rest of your life. I mean, I was going crazy. That's the thing they don't tell you in rehab. They don't tell you you're going to get sober and you're going to get a whole lot of hours every day and you're not going to know what to do with it and you're going to go crazy, you know. And they say, go to a meeting. Well, that's great. But a meeting is an hour, you know. What about the other 23? So I, not knowing what to do, reverted to my old childhood ways and I began to write. And I began writing on the day I got out of rehab, and I didn't stop. And I just like to tell people, you know, wasn't that long ago. I have not been writing for 20 years. I have not been writing for 15 years. You know, this is since 1999. This is 1999 is when all, you know, this sort of started. The before and the after of my life is just stunning. The reinvention that occurred as a result of not drinking, you know, as a result of just of not doing that. That's what has been sort of the V8 moment. Wow, I could have had a V8 on a profound level. That's what it's been like. Just realizing, man, you know, I wasted so much time.
This has been a conversation with Augustine Burroughs, author of Dry and Running with Scissors. Augustine Burroughs is also the author of the best-selling novel, Cellavision. For more information, point your internet browser to augustine.com. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Today's a little better, I'm a little less insane. Yesterday is littered with my innocent remains. Today's a little better, I'm not trying to run away. Not feeling quite as bitter, it's a little bit of better every day.
Augustine Burroughs has, to date, written 8 memoirs, a novel, and a self-help book. Last year, he published his first picture book for children, My Little Thief. His first novel in over 20 years is called The Debris Field, and is due to be released later this year. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Joe Bainline and produced by Brian DeShazer. Steve Pride was our archival correspondent. You heard music by Traffic and Paxton. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Steve Sims of Seattle, Washington, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lisa Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 2NCR, South Lismore, New South Wales, WMPG, Portland, Maine. Welcome aboard to KQUA, The River, Roseburg, Oregon, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and do stay tuned.